The rise of authoritarianism around the world, including in the U.S., has challenged the standard view that the American political system has been a model for other countries to follow. But according to Sam Farber, a retired professor at Brooklyn College at the City University of New York, the rise of authoritarianism is not so surprising when you consider that the U.S. political system might be one of the least democratic among all the capitalist democracies. He argues in a piece called Reflections on Arbitrariness that appears in the summer issue of New Politics that one of the main components of this authoritarianism is its arbitrariness. That, he says, is why President Trump is such a poor representative of the U.S. ruling class. KGVM contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Farber about arbitrariness and its relationship to the work world, the Trump administration, and the 2000 presidential contest between Al Gore and George W. Bush.
Is arbitrariness the same as impulsiveness? Trump has often been accused of being impulsive. Do you mean...
No, I think that arbitrariness is certainly related to authoritarianism, which is that Trump has been accused with very solid reasons. But what I think, my purpose in writing this is that I think that people, that's my estimation, are not as aware of the importance of arbitrariness as they are. And that's what I started talking about, the situation at work and how that has become an important issue in the Starbucks stores that have been unionized, when the management tells people at the last minute to come to work, even though this might affect their family relations, their children, you know, the whole thing, their sleep patterns, the work. And they just do it nonchalantly. From the point of view of management, makes sense, but certainly not from the point of view of workers. Similarly, I think that in the case of Trump, I think that arbitrariness is a key, in my view, a key factor for why Trump is not a organic expression of the ruling class in this country, precisely because in his arbitrariness, he cannot even follow the rules. There are rules, explicit rules of what it is to be a spokesperson or an executive for the ruling class.
That's why you brought up Al Gore.
And that's what I've been reading about Al Gore, who I'm surprised that this comparison hasn't been made before, because Al Gore had a far, 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 far stronger case to make from at none. To make for the election being stolen, but still he decided he wanted to bring costs to Kennedy County, Florida. He decided to go in place. The point he made, the way he explained it, I think it clearly indicates that this guy was standing to what he perceived, correctly, in my opinion, as the interest of the ruling class in a predictable, orderly succession in government, without the complete contempt for the rules that Trump had. That is, it isn't the interest of the ruler to minimize the danger of instability. And that's exactly what Al Gore was doing, that Trump was the exact opposite of that. Because even though Gore went along with the Supreme Court in a situation where he had a tremendous case for having won the election, and he still gave up the fight, Trump had absolutely no case, none whatsoever, for having won the election, continued with the consequences that we're aware of. And that comparison, I think, is very key. Because, again, my point is that arbitrariness is very closely related to whether or not the President of the United States is acting as an agent, in some sense, an agent of the ruling class, rather than a person who is exterior to it. That's an argument I ask. Of course, he will accommodate to big business and so on, but it's not the same thing as big business being able to rely on somebody who's going to act rationally and consistently and coherently in their interest. They cannot count on that.
But a lot of Democrats were very disappointed in Gore. They thought, as you said, that he had a good case and he gave up too easily, and in a sense, he betrayed his party. Did you get that sense? Yeah.
The point is that his party, first of all, is striking, and then he made the registration because I think it's a very pertinent one. I think the Republicans, they would absolutely love to look at his party for what he did. an electoral party. They're not a party of the people in the sense that in one of the countries of the world, you know, there, you know, there's a membership party. And Jeremy Corbyn could not conceivably become, or equivalent to that, become the head of the Democratic Party any more than Bernie Sanders did. Because the Democrat is not really a party in the sense of a membership that decides issues. It is a combination of people who are fundraisers, committees, manage a tremendous amount of money, as I pointed out in my essay, what Kamala Harris spent in her election, and they're not, there's no there. It's an electoral machine. It's not a membership party.
Yeah, it's not ideologically driven. I think sometimes when people on the left attack the Democrats, they seem to think it is an ideological party.
The ideology is the free market.
Yeah.
To the extent that one can say that Democratic ideology it is the free market with some modifications of what is a very modest welfare state. If you look at the welfare state in the United States, even before Trump, compared to European countries, a very modest, you know, welfare state. In Scandinavia, you know, university education is still free, to give you an example.
Even with the swing to a more conservative politics, still.
Yeah. Okay. In Scandinavia, that has been most of the rule. Without any recently welfare state, but even so, the welfare state was so extensive that even after it's done, it's kept as more important feature than the case in the United States. And now with the offensive of Medicaid that came out of this disgusting Congress that just like sheep in the slaughter, we just went along with Trump. So I think that the welfare state is even more reduced.
Getting back to the notion of arbitrariness, what about his plan to take over Canada and Greenland? You pointed those out as examples as well. Could you talk about that?
Yes, right. You know, this is, if somebody was concerned, let's say, about how the big banks in the U.S. and the big private equity, how that would respond, they wouldn't be making pronouncements like that, which are completely out of nowhere. Of course, one thing that Trump achieved was that the Liberal Party in Canada was way behind. Because of Trump was able to win the election, a tremendous hostility to Trump in Canada, and the same thing happened in Australia. You know, the Liberal Party in Australia won the election. They came from behind because of Trump and the tariffs. You know, so in every way, I think that those Texas Democrats who have fled Texas as they should have. Maybe should consider going to Canada because Trump is going to try to get him arrested and personally return to Texas. So if I were in their shoes, I think they should move a little farther north and go to Canada where the FBI cannot reach them.
Yeah, maybe you should try to get a hold of them and see if they'll do that.
Yeah, you know, they're waiting to hear from me.
Yeah. Wow.
No, but to me, I think it's a commonsensical thing.
And so
the FBI is going to arrest these people. Well, you know, flip the balance. And they will be welcome with open arms in Canada. The anti-Trump sentiment in Canada is quite formidable.
And another arbitrary decision, or, well, not that he can necessarily carry it through, was to make Gaza a resort and move the whole...
That's goddamn outrageous, you know.
Yeah.
And it's arbitrary because it follows, for example, I can imagine that the Singapore Prince, you know, that the Imperial Government of the U.S. is, would develop a scheme to try to take over Greenland. Even then, they wouldn't pursue the way Trump does. Who declares in the early part of his taking power, who declares, well, of course, it should be ours. Without speaking to anybody in Europe, or, you know what I'm saying, this stuff.
And yet he is forced into negotiations, you know, he has sent
it. But it appears that the native people in Greenland are not particularly interested. They want independence from Greenland, from Denmark. But there doesn't seem to be any enthusiasm whatsoever for joining the U.S. came of them being able to gather from the interviews.
That's retired Brooklyn College professor Sam Farber speaking with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg. This interview was released on September 11th, 2025.